Okay, I hope that eventually I will be able to talk about galactic magnetic fields and how to get them from inflation. This is me, Konstantinos Dimopoulos. I'm actually at the moment at Lagos University working with David Light, but this is an earlier work which has been published this year with Anne Davis, Tomislav Prokopek, and Ola Tongqvist. I'm actually not going to present this issue in the way that it is published in the paper. In the paper you can find a much more rigorous and detailed calculation. This is a completely alternative approach, which is a bit more heuristic, but I think that it's more descriptive and it's more conceptually appealing, so, and also it's quicker. So that's why I decided to present this one. The results are exactly the same, which is a reassuring thing. Okay, so what about magnetic fields and galactic magnetic fields in particular? Well, it has been observed that most of the galaxies possess magnetic fields of the order of microgauss. This is the equipartition strength between the magnetic field energy density and the kinetic energy density of the rotation of the galaxy. These fields in spiral galaxies follow the spiral structure, so this is strong evidence that they are supported and sustained by a dynamo mechanism. A dynamo mechanism, the alpha-omega dynamo mechanism, in fact, are able to amplify a weak seed field using the interplay between the turbulence of the gas and the differential rotation of the galaxy, are able to amplify a seed field up to a equipartition value, started from a very weak but non-zero initial field strength. So in order to account for the observed magnetic field of the galaxies, one needs a seed field whose origin until now remains elusive. Such a seed field has to satisfy certain requirements of strength and coherence, which are basically as shown here. It has to be at least 10 to the minus 30 gauss strong for a lambda CDM universe, and it has to be coherent at least over the scale of the largest turbulent eddy of the dynamo, which is about 100 parsec. So, in search of this, of the origin of this seed field, there are a number of mechanisms suggested and discussed in the literature, which roughly can be divided into two groups: the astrophysical mechanisms and the primordial mechanisms. Sorry, excuse me. Well, basically, what you have an exponential amplification. The dynamo mechanism arranges more or less all the dynamo models. There are a number of models. They differ in details of what the alpha effect is in one, and the alpha effect has to do with the turbulence. But the overall effect is to have an exponential amplification on the time scale of a galactic revolution. So basically, what you do is gets these numbers is that you have the present field, and then you say, in a lambda CDM how all the galaxies are supposed to be, and I know the time scale for their evolution, and which means that I know in order to get this field, which field I would need to start with. That's one thing. As far as the coherence is concerned, there has been a number of papers on that one, which they have shown that an incoherent, so a field that may be strong enough but incoherent, so the coherence length would be smaller than this mentioned here, would actually destabilize the dynamo action and destroy it. So this is a lower bound. I mean, it can be much more coherent, this one. It would be very nice if you had a strong field which is more coherent. So these are the minimum requirements.
You might include your expectation to the next few shows to see evidence of still a high redshift. And there haven't been very many rotations.
That's true, but. That's true. That's why I said that this is a minimum requirement for most of the galaxies. On the other hand, intergalactic magnetic fields and things like that can be associated with other phenomena like jets, AGNs, and things. So, and I'm going to actually mention this here in the Biermann battery part. So, it's not that only, but we believe that the galaxies, not all the galaxies can be associated with such phenomena, with active starburst activity and things like that. So we believe, well, a lot of people believe that that one needs some kind of other seed field to see the galactic magnetic fields, which are present in all galaxies observed. The galaxy formation, the thing that is, well, I'll come back to that. I'll come back to that later. Well, the galaxy itself has done more working in it. The collapse of the galaxy does some things in the magnetic field if the magnetic field pre-exists the collapse. So, the astrophysical seed fields, basically, the astrophysical mechanisms for getting a seed field are basically of three different types. One is the battery mechanisms. These are based on misalignment between density and pressure gradients, or large-scale misalignment, which can be only associated with large-scale lobe jets of active galactic nuclei and so forth. And as I said, it's hard to believe that such activity is associated with all the galaxies that we observe today. The second idea was to use... Yes? That. Well, of course, one can suppose that all the galaxies had gone through an active galactic nuclei phase. But I think that, you know, this is a bit speculative. Of course, I'm not saying that there weren't any, but can you actually have a definite statement saying that all the galaxies go through this phase? Because all the galaxies that can be observed have magnetic fields. Well, anyway, I cannot exclude, of course, there is some literature on Biermann battery mechanisms on that. Usually, the magnetic fields in these cases are not inside the galaxy itself. It's on the jet. The jet itself, which has this misalignment of density and pressure that is required for the EMF, produces magnetic fields that mostly would populate the intergalactic medium, not the galaxy itself. But I cannot be 100% certain on this one. Anyway, the second idea was to use stellar fields and stellar magnetic fields that may be ejected into the interstellar medium by stellar explosions. The problem is that they are very much incoherent, and so they don't satisfy this second requirement here. One idea to overcome this was to use the so-called small-scale dynamo, an intermediate state of amplification of this field until they are of enough strength and coherence to trigger the galactic dynamo. But the existence of such a mechanism, indirect mechanism, is speculated. There is no evidence for that. The third way to generate magnetic fields in the galaxies in an astrophysical manner is use vertical effects. The vertical motions of ionized plasma generate circular currents because the ion and the electron fluid rotate in different velocities. But the problem is that in order to generate sufficiently strong magnetic fields, you have to have a strongly ionized plasma, which is hard to achieve as late as the epoch of galaxy formation for all the galaxies. So all these considerations have led people to seek the origin of the seed field for the galactic dynamo in ages pre-existing the formation of the galaxies themselves, and in that sense, the seed field was considered to be truly primordial. Now, yes? What is intergalactic shunt? I don't understand the term. Shocks, you mean? Ah, sorry. Good. Yes. I don't know this. I haven't seen it. I suppose, but well, I don't know about that. We may have to discuss about it later when you show me the paper or something. Well, anyway, to proceed, excluding the possibility that there may be an efficient astrophysical mechanism, there is also the possibility of generating the magnetic field, the required field in the early universe. However, in order to have a magnetic field generation before recombination, one needs to be in a state of not thermal equilibrium, because such a large-scale field would break isotropy. So this limits the choice basically between generating a magnetic field in a phase transition or during inflation. There is substantial work done in both directions. The problem with phase transitions is that any mechanism that one can think of is a causal mechanism, in the sense that the coherence length of the magnetic field is bounded by the horizon at that time. And because the phase transitions in the Hot Big Bang occur very, very early in the history of the universe, the commuting size of the horizon is very small. For instance, for the breaking of crowd unification, you have sizes of the order of a centimeter. The best case is the quark confinement transition, the QCD transition, which even that has a coherent, has a commuting, corresponds to a commuting scale of about one astronomical unit. So this is also too small compared to the coherence requirement. So it seems that unless one invokes inverse cascade mechanisms, and in one earlier work of mine, I have shown that even that does not work for phase transitions, you can get this this much of enlargement of the coherence length. The only way to achieve substantial correlation in a primordial seed field is to actually generate the field during inflation. But the problem here is that the conformal invariance of electromagnetism results in the magnetic field flux being conserved during inflation, which means that because the scale factor, which means that it's inversely proportional to the square of the scale factor, and because the scale factor grows exponentially or almost exponentially during inflation, the amplitude of the magnetic field, if it was produced during inflation, would be exponentially suppressed. So we have that. So we reach to the conclusion that during phase transition, one can have possibly substantial strength in the magnetic field generated, but cannot achieve the coherence requirement. And the opposite is true during inflation. If you generate it during inflation, you can have the coherence, but not the strength. Of course, in order to overcome the latest problem, people have actually attempted to break the conformal invariance of electromagnetism during inflation by a number of ways, usually introducing terms in the Lagrangian that explicitly break this by coupling the photon directly to gravity, or to a scalar or pseudo-scalar field, or considering the conformal anomaly, or things like that. We, in fact, have found another way to show that the conformal invariance is actually naturally broken during inflation. And this would result in the generation of of substantial magnetic field, that would be a successful ship, a galactic dynamo, and that's what I'm going to talk about. Okay. At last, we'll move to the second part. Inflation magnetic field. I'm sure you are all familiar what inflation is. Basically, the idea is that at some point in the universe evolution, the density of the universe is dominated by is dominated by some component that has an almost constant energy density. This is typically the potential density of a scalar field, but it may not be so. Whatever it is, a constant energy density results, if you see it from the spatially flat Friedmann equation here, results immediately in exponential expansion. Or if it's not exactly constant, it would be quasi-exponential expansion. So exponential expansion, this h here is the Hubble parameter which remains approximately constant in during inflation. So we have something like a de Sitter expansion of the universe. This means that if there was any pre-existing thermal bath, exactly because the temperature of the thermal bath is inverse proportional to the scale factor, the temperature would go rapidly exponentially to zero. So an effect which is usually referred to as supercooling. The temperature would rise again at the end of inflation, where the potential density that drives inflation is supposed to decay to a thermal bath of to the thermal bath of the hot Big Bang. And for a prompt decay, the reheating temperature, that's what it's called, reheating temperature, is of the order of the energy scale of inflation. It's a simple idea that manages in a single stroke to solve the horizon of flatness problems of the hot Big Bang, the bonobo problems of unification theories. And also, if you consider an Eflaton field to provide also the seeds for large-scale structure and also for the cosmic microwave background anisotropies. In fact, you may not even consider an Eflaton field if you consider a Kerveton field. So, what about magnetic fields? Well, what happens in inflation is that the quantum fluctuations of gauge fields are inflated and they become long-range gauge fields with superhorizon correlation. That's true anyway. Our problem is that because of the confocal invariance, the amplitude of these superhorizon gauge fields would be exponentially suppressed. But our idea here is not to break the conformal invariance artificially, to break the conformal invariance of the photon, but to consider, in contrast, the Z boson. The Z boson field, whose conformal invariance is naturally broken during inflation, I'll show why. And this can be shown to generate a substantial superhorizon hypermagnetic field at the end of inflation, which will transform itself into a regular magnetic field and electroweak phase transition. The logic of the mechanism is as follows. As I said, during inflation, supercooling means that the temperature goes to zero, which means that all the symmetries of nature are broken. The same is true for the electroweak symmetry. This means that the Z boson field becomes massive. The mass of the field breaks conformal invariance in the field of variations. So the Z boson field, in contrast to the photon which is massless, is generated during inflation. I'll talk about this in detail later. Just later on, at the end of inflation, because the reheating temperature, yes? No, they are generated. The problem is that what happens to the fluctuations after they are generated? Well, if a field has a mass that is larger than the Hubble parameter, they are not generated. I'll talk about this later in detail. If the mass is smaller but non-zero than the Hubble parameter, then the fluctuations are generated, but because it's non-zero, the mass, the conformal invariance is broken, and you have gravitational production. If the mass is zero, then the conformal mass is not broken. This means that basically the gauge field is not really coupled to the gravitational background, so it doesn't receive any energy from it. So it decays exponentially because the universe expands. Whereas if it is coupled, if there is a conformal invariance breakdown, this means that in the gauge field equation of motion, there are sources that have to do with the gravitational background, source terms, like which include the scale factor, for instance. And these pump energy into the Gates field so that it gets gravitationally generated. But I'll talk about this in more detail later. Now I'm just sketching the idea. The idea is that the Z boson has its conformal invariance broken during inflation, so it's generated. At the end of inflation, reheating, usually the reheating temperature typically is larger than the electroweak scale, so we have electroweak unification, which means that the Z boson and the photon combine to form the hypercharge field. But the photon, since it has not been gravitationally produced, is negligible, the photon's contribution. So what we have actually is a projection of the Z boson spectrum on the hypercharge direction through the Weber angle here. So the hypercharge field is actually is an abelian massless Gates field. So one can define a hypermagnetic field in exactly just the same way as in the photon case, as shown there. And because the origin of the Z boson spectrum is actually based on the quantum fluctuations, they are stochastic and random. So basically, you expect to have both a hyperelectric and hypermagnetic field, but the hyperelectric component is screened, is the Debye screen, so it decays, so we can forget about it. On the other hand, the hypermagnetic component freezes into the heated plasma. This is because the hypercharge being abelian and massless satisfies the equivalent of Maxwell's equation. So magnetohydrodynamics is more or less the same for the hypercharge field. And that's why, since we have a huge conductivity after the end of inflation in the newly formed thermal bath, the magnetic field is expected to freeze. And therefore, we can trace its evolution by considering flux conservation. So it scales as the inverse square of the scale factor here. There are also the same mechanism that produces the Z boson field also produces the W magnetic fields. But the problem is that they are non-abelian and they have self-interaction terms, so they are screened because they exhibit a non-perturbative magnetic mass. So we can forget about those as well. So the hypermagnetic field is scaled down until much later than the end of inflation, when the electroweak transition, when the temperature falls below the electroweak scale, so the electroweak transition takes place, and electromagnetism is obtained, and we can have the photon from the hypercharge and the Ws. As we said, the Ws are screened and they decay, so their contribution is again negligible. So what we have is the projection now of the hypercharge spectrum onto the photon direction, which means that the hypermagnetic field at the electroweak transition is transformed into a magnetic field, again through the Weber angle here. So, starting with the Z field, we obtained a photon field, even though these directions are orthogonal. And the idea is that it's like light polarizers. If you have two vertical polarizers perpendicular to each other, no light can go through. But if you insert a third polarizer in an angle theta here, then you can have some light going through, because you can have the projection on this third direction here, which in our case is the right direction of the hypercharge. So our mechanism works only if between reheating and galaxy formation there is a period where the universe, where the electroweak symmetry is restored. But that's something that typically happens with inflationary models. So let's go in more detail about Z production. This is not, as I said, the rigorous calculation. This is a more graphic way of presenting things. As I said, we are actually based on the production of quantum fluctuations of the Z field during inflation. The quantum fluctuations, of course, satisfy the uncertainty relation. They are able to reach an exit of horizon only if their Compton wavelength is larger than the horizon size during inflation, which in fact means that the mass has to be smaller than the Hubble parameter during inflation. That's what I said before. Now, then it's very easy to estimate the amplitude of such a fluctuation when at horizon crossing, considering the fact that the volume of the horizon is given by the Hubble parameter and the time that it takes for the fluctuation to reach the horizon and exit is again given by the Hubble parameter, and all the derivatives of the because this is basically the energy density is given by the kinetic terms are also determined by the Hubble parameter. Basically, the Hubble parameter is the only dynamical scale here. So what you get is that that the amplitude of the fluctuation at horizon crossing is not surprisingly given by the Hubble parameter. In fact, it is given by the Hawking temperature here. So it's the Hubble parameter over 2 pi. And you can understand this as follows. You can consider that the particle horizon during inflation acts in a similar way as the event horizon of an inverted black hole, an inside-out black hole, in the sense that nothing can be escaped being sucked out. So the self-similarity of the Cp space of exponentially expanding of a universe suggests, because this Hubble parameter is constant, suggests that the amplitude of the fluctuation at horizon crossing is not does not depend on the exact moment that horizon crossing occurs. It's actually the same whenever at whichever part of time in inflation this occurs. So the initial amplitude for at horizon exit of all fluctuations is the same given by the Hawking temperature, provided of course the mass is smaller than the mass of the field is smaller than the Hubble parameter. Now after horizon crossing, the fluctuation becomes yes. It will come into the game. No, not here. Not here. Even the photon fluctuations are generated as such. What conformal variance has to do with what happens to the fluctuation after the exit. It exits the horizon. So this is just to give you an estimate of the amplitude of the fluctuation at horizon crossing. So the only difference is whether you have a really massive field or an effectively massless field. If you have a massive field with mass larger than the Hubble parameter, then you have basically zero, because it's exponentially suppressed before it reaches the horizon, because the uncertainty relation has time to kill the fluctuation before it reaches the horizon if it's massive. But if it's not, then effectively it's massless, which means that it reaches the horizon with the speed of light, and the uncertainty relation cannot act on it before it reaches the horizon. Now, after it reaches the horizon, next is the horizon, the fluctuation becomes causally self-disconnected, which means that it cannot collapse to itself now. And the uncertainty relation cannot kill it. And in that sense, after a few foldings, becomes from a virtual into a real object. So it is a classical object, and that's why we have to treat it classically. And in that way, the Z boson that I'm talking about here, but any other field, it may be produced gravitationally on superhorizon scales if it's effectively massless. So let's consider the superhorizon evolution during inflation. So we now consider the classical evolution of the fluctuation in question. The classical equation of motion of a gauge field is this one. You can consider also the photon in this one. You just change everything into A's here, and this is the mass of the photon, which is zero. I'll talk about this case later on. But now let's focus on to the Z. Now, I consider the spatial component of this equation and the Friedman-Robinson-Walker, especially flat Friedman-Robinson-Walker metric with the scale factor of loss growing exponentially. If you do that, this equation gives you this equation here. Now, since we are talking about a specific fluctuation that exits the horizon and we follow this at superhorizon scale, the fluctuation equation is causally connected at horizon crossing because it begins at subhorizon. So we can consider it as smooth. And because the Friedman-Robinson-Walker metric is homogeneous anisotropic, we expect that this fluctuation to remain smooth even on superhorizon scales. In that hand-waving argument, I can ignore the spatial derivatives on this equation and consider only the time derivatives. In which case, this equation reduces to this very easy linear differential equation. We can solve this using the correct initial conditions at horizon crossing, and we obtain this solution here, where nu is given by this quantity. Yes?
I read on the first question of the
Uh-huh. But there is no direct coupling to the capacitor of the gauge fields unless I put an additional term in the Ragnarsen that makes it so. I think it's just the outcome of the form of the Lagrangian of the system. Yes, no. This trick has been used for breaking the conformal invariance of the photon. As I said previously in the introduction, people have introduced by hand terms where they have R A squared in the Lagrangian. Conformal invariance. M gauge invariance, yes. I'm going to talk about this. Until now, let's just consider that this is non-zero. That's the only thing. Then I'm going to talk of exactly what this is and what the electroweak field has to do with it. So that's the solution of this equation. Where I consider that this is approximately this is constant. As we see, this is not exactly so. It's logarithmically dependent, but the result doesn't really change on that. So it's logarithmically dependent on conformal time. So anyway, that's the solution here. You can see that the solution again reflects the self-similarity of the Sitter space in the sense that it's independent explicitly of the horizon crossing time of the particular fluctuation. It depends only on the interval, on the time after that has passed after the fluctuation exited the horizon. Now I want to switch into expressing things using the physical momentum of the commoting momentum here, which is inversely proportional to the scale factor and equals, of course, the horizon and horizon crossing. By doing so, you can express the exponential factors as such. And then you obtain this solution. Also consider the fact that the mass here is supposed to be much smaller than the Hubble parameter. Otherwise, we have no gravitational production in the first place. And if you do that, this n here becomes approximately equal to this, and then you get this solution, which, if you evaluate it at the end of inflation, provides the super horizon spectrum of the Z boson or of any gauge boson at the end of inflation. Now, we see, yes? Yes. Yes, exactly. Yes. If you write the Klein Gordon of the scalar field, you get the three, but not here. So anyway, that's a superhorizon spectrum of the gauge field. There are two terms here to be compared. This one is obviously larger for non-zero mass than this one because this ratio here is very, very much smaller than unity, but this exponent here is much smaller than unity. So this term here is subdominant, unless of course you have a zero mass as the photon, in which case this is the dominant term. But I'll talk about what the mass is right now. So what is the origin of the Z field mass? Well, the mass of the Z field is provided by the coupling of the Z field with the electroweak Higgs field. Now, the electroweak Higgs field is an effectively massless field in the sense that it has a mass much smaller than the Hubble parameter during inflation, typically for realistic models of inflation. This means that the electroweak Higgs field is gravitationally produced, as we said before. The fluctuations exit the horizon. In the case of scalar fields, the amplitude of the fluctuation remains constant after horizon exit. What happens is that you have a contribution of this. So every e-folding, there is the gravitational production of such a fluctuation. This quantity here corresponds a random walk in the interspace. This fluctuation pile onto each other in a random walk. so that after delta n e, delta n e foldings, you have this square root factor of n here. So what you have is basically that this quantity is the amplitude of the fluctuation itself times the random walk factor here. And because then the number of e-foldings is, of course, logarithmically dependent on the scale factor, you have, and the scale factor is connected with the physical momentum, what you have is that there is some dependence on the mass of the mass on the scale, but it's a logarithmic dependence, which we do not expect to affect the results. So this factor that appears in the spectrum here so this factor here is given actually by an expression of this form. So what happens is that the electroweak Higgs field forms a condensate of order of the Hubble parameter, and because of course the Gates coupling is smaller than unity, you have that the mass of the Z field is smaller than the Hubble parameter, but is not zero and is not infinitesimal. It is given, it's of the order but smaller of the Hubble parameter. And so anyway, for the scales of interest, the commuting scales that will be interested, this is about 100, which means that this is very small, so that this term dominates over this one. And you have that the spectrum of the Z field is roughly given by this, so it's almost scale invariant if you disregard this term, with just a very logarithmic tilt, because this one here depends on logarithmically on k. So the field is almost scale invariant. In contrast, the photon case could have the field exactly massless. So in this equation here, this term would disappear, and only this term would remain, which means that the photon spectrum would be something like that. This is inversely proportional to scale. So you can imagine that for scales, so very large super horizon scales, the ones that we are interested in, the cosmological scales, this is completely negligible compared to the Z boson. So
when you charge scalars like the same thing happened.
Yes. In our first letter that we didn't actually consider the Z boson. We mentioned about in general scalar electrodynamics with such coupling. But the paper actually considers this because it's more natural. It's completely out of the standard model. You don't need to introduce any other things. You don't even need to introduce an inflaton for this one. You can have inflation by other means. Only the standard model. And of course, you need to have inflation with a reheating pattern so that it's high enough for the electric to be restored. That's the only requirement. Yes? The total, not the 60, it cannot be a million. It's something like 1,000 or something is okay. Yes, because otherwise the mass of the field would exceed the Hubble parameter. Yes, that was with 100 foldings. That was with 100. Yes, but you can have it a bit larger. But not infinitely, yes.
These things really random up without bounds, but there are potentials. There are according potentials and so on.
No, not on the. Since we are talking. Here is where we will need the blackboard. Since we are talking about the electroweak Higgs field, the potential. So this is the potential, say. Mm-hmm. This is the mass of the electroweak. So this is 100. GeV, roughly. But the scales that we are talking about are of the order of the Hubble parameter, the delta C. This is much more. I mean, for God scale inflation, the random walk is.
It's quartic. It's not just quadratic, it's quartic. So as you get up far enough, it'll start to. It's more than a mass term. There's a Higgs, the lambda Higgs to the fourth term.
Yes, yes. Yes, there is this.
Random walk.
No, the point is that all these fluctuations are quantum. You are inside the horizon. They don't really feel the existence of the potential at all. Yes. There are a lot of, well, if you write down the question, of course, you have also couplings to the gauge fields and everything. All of them, except, are subdominant to the self-coupling, and this one is also subdominant to the. We have actually an estimate of this in the paper, using the Sartree approximation for the random fluctuations. So. So let's go to the magnetic field now. So as I said, we produce the Z boson spectrum that I just showed. This projects onto the hypercharge because the photon contribution is negligible. Later on, so you produce an initial hypermagnetic field at the end of inflation, which can be estimated as such due to its definition. Later on, of course, it will get transformed into a regular magnetic field, again through the projection to the on the Weimer angle. So let's follow the evolution of this hypermagnetic field, or magnetic field in general. The magnetic field today, following flux conservation, would have been given by this expression. The initial one at the end of inflation, this is the suppression factor because of the expansion of the universe, conserving flux, and this of course has to do with the projection at the electroweak phase transition. This is the commoving magnetic field, meaning the magnetic field as it would have been today, where there are no structure formation, no galactic collapse, nothing. But exactly because this is not so, and exactly because we are interested in the magnetic field at galaxy formation and not today, we scale back the whole thing to galaxy formation. So this redshift here is about 3 or 4. So this factor is 25 or something. And we get this expression where I actually also used this relation to go to the Z spectrum, and I also expressed the physical momentum here in terms of the commoving wavelength, the scale today. So that's the expression that we have. There is an additional amplification factor having to do with the galactic collapse itself, because the galaxy as it collapses, since the field is frozen into the plasma, compresses the plasma, which can be estimated to be of about of the order of 5,000. And if you put in the numbers, you get this result here, where the Z, this almost scaling Vara spectrum, is what we have shown. We consider now the scale of the largest turbulent entity, the 100 parsec that we said, but before the galactic collapse, which corresponds to about 10 kiloparsecs. And if you consider inflation of the order of grand unification, which is the scale that the simplest models of inflation suggest based on Cobb normalization, you can get an estimate of the seed field on this scale to be 10 to the minus 30 Gauss, which is sufficient to trigger the galactic dynamo in a lambda CDM in a dark energy dominated, spatially flat universe. And just to show you what the effect of the whole gravitational production is, you see here the spectrum of the magnetic. This is the commoving field now. So it's the field as it would have been today where there are no galactic collapse. So it's suppressed by a factor of 10,000, about that. So the gravitational production means that the magnetic field is inversely proportional to the scale because the Z boson spectrum is scale invariant. Whereas the vacuum, which would have the photon spectrum, which is inversely proportional to the scale, means that the vacuum magnetic field would have been inversely proportional to the scale squared. So you see that there is this huge difference on the scales of interest. These are the scales of interest, the 10 kiloparsec scale. We are talking about how many? Almost 20 orders of magnitude difference. And that's the effect of the gravitational production of the Z boson. So, just to conclude, what we have shown is that all inflationary models with inflation on the grand unification scale generate magnetic fields of enough strength and coherence to successfully seed the galactic dynamo and explain thereby the observed galactic fields. These magnetic fields generated due to the gravitational production of the Z boson field, whose conformal invariance is naturally broken during inflation. The superhorizon spectrum of the Z is approximately scale invariant, and is projected onto the hypercharged field at reheating, when electroximetry is restored. The corresponding hypermagnetic field freezes into the plasma and evolves satisfying flux conservation until galax formation. At the electroic transition, of course, the hypermagnetic field transforms into a regular magnetic field. Extra amplification, I didn't talk about that, is possible and may achieve if you consider that these fields are actually coupled with the oscillating fields at preheating, so you have explosive parametric resonance phenomena. You can have up to a couple of orders of magnitude of amplification. In the paper, we consider a specific model of hybrid inflation with the flipped SU5 as the grand unified group, in which case the amplification is not important, is of order unit. So it doesn't matter, but it's model dependent. It depends on the model of the gap. So you can have up to this. And also you can have additional enhancement, possibly, if you consider inverse cascade effects or helical turbulence. We have actually looked into that too. You can see it here in the graph. This is the effect of helical turbulence. It had to be some horizon for it to start operating. And on the scale of interest, is not really substantial. It's about an order of 20 or something, 17, in fact. So to conclude, this is a model-independent mechanism. It doesn't depend on the inflationary model. And can be thought of as a result, as a feature of the inflationary theory itself. Since grand unified scale inflationary models are the most typical realization due to Cobe normalization, we conclude that accounting for the observed galactic magnetic fields can be considered as another generic success of inflation. Thank you.